This is a podcast from The Red House, the former home of Benjamin Britten and Peter Piers. I'm Lucy Walker. Join me, colleagues and other guests for a monthly chat about all things Britten and Piers, plus music, culture, heritage in general, and anything else that might come up. Welcome to the From the Red House podcast. This is season 3, episode 2. And I'm really, really pleased to be joined by Anna Maria Barry, who is a historian. Anna writes about all number of different subjects. And we're going to have a conversation about her very wide-ranging interests. So hello, Anna.
Hello, Lucy.
Hi, it's great to talk to you on this rather dreary Wednesday morning. Still in lockdown. So yes, Anna, one of the reasons I was interested to talk to you is you do have quite a broad range of historical interests. But perhaps to start with, if you could just give a brief kind of biog of you, of how you got to where you are, what your PhD was in, and just basically your route to today in terms of your career.
Okay. So I research and write about a number of different topics that fall, I suppose, broadly under the umbrella of 19th century studies. So I've always been very interested in art and music and the relationship between those two art forms, and also celebrity studies and gender. So my PhD was on 19th century opera singers. I was looking at the sometimes controversial figure of the opera singer in 19th century Britain and how they presented themselves to the public, how they were seen by the public, looking at things like portraits and autobiographies. And for the last few years, though, I've been, my focus has shifted a little bit, and I've been working on two projects mainly. One to do with musical portraits, so looking at portraits of musicians in the 19th century, and also looking at celebrity and death. So I'm particularly interested in post-mortem portraits of celebrities and particularly musicians. And death masks in particular.
So lots to think about there, and the idea that death masks are a kind of portrait is really interesting. We'll come back to that. But perhaps we could talk about first the notion of celebrity as it relates to the 19th century, how that differs to celebrity today, or how it's similar perhaps.
So I think I was always surprised to see how many similarities there were between celebrity culture in the 19th century and today. You know, today we talk a lot about images of famous people. There's lots, you know, social media and selfies and things like that. Images circulated to a surprising degree in the 19th century as well. It always surprised me to hear that even before the age of photography, for instance, celebrities would be spotted on the street and hassled by people when they were, you know, traveling around and going about their daily business. It's always really interesting to look at things like interviews. And autobiographies in the 19th century were a really important way in which famous people communicated with the public, and people felt like they got to know famous people and kind of develop a relationship with artists and musicians through some of those mediums.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. And so how was that material circulated then? Was it through publications? Were they on the front of scores, or how did that work?
Yeah, so images circulated in a variety of different ways. There were specialist print shops where people could buy prints of famous musicians and actors that they admired. They were reproduced widely in newspapers and in the press, sheet music covers, like you said. Later on in the 19th century, when photography was more developed, carte de visite, or kind of collectible cards of favourite musicians and authors, were something that people could collect and put in albums and display in their homes. So these images did circulate really widely, to a surprising degree, actually.
And you also said something about the controversial figure of the 19th century opera singer. What was the controversy around that?
So my PhD, I looked particularly at male opera singers and how they were sort of seen by certain Victorian audiences, particularly Italian opera singers. There's lots and lots of Victorian novels about villainous Italian opera singers. They were seen as these sort of southern European Catholic seductive figures that were a risk to women. You know, opera was seen as a very unrestrained art form. It wasn't very compatible with some British ideas about reserve. And that's reflected in all sorts of things in the 19th century, but novels in particular. There's all sorts of hilarious novels written by women about, you know, someone's music teacher who was a dastardly opera singer kidnapping somebody and running off to Italy with her. So what I was actually looking at is how British male opera singers negotiated these problems, because it was you know, it was very difficult in terms of national identity and masculinity for a British man to establish himself as an opera singer in this period. So I was looking at some of the ways that they did that. One way that was quite surprising was in the early 19th century, a lot of male opera singers developed a relationship with the Navy, say during the Napoleonic Wars, singing patriotic songs and tributes to Nelson and dressing up as sailors on stage as a way of kind of rebranding themselves as more patriotic figures. That was one way that they did them, writing autobiographies. A lot of British male opera singers wrote these quite incredible autobiographies. Charles Santley is somebody who I was particularly interested in. He was a baritone who became the first ever singer to be knighted in Britain. But he wrote several volumes of autobiography about his swashbuckling adventures around the world. So he talked about trekking across the desert on a camel while he was on his way to sing in Australia and fighting with criminals in India and all sorts of different stories that kind of served to present himself as this sort of man of the world and man of empire rather than an opera singer. He said, he even said, I'm a sailor first and a singer second.
Goodness. How extraordinary. I mean, I want to get hold of some of these novels. They sound amazing. But that, how extraordinary that it's not, that opera singing was seen as something you had to kind of not identify with as being an opera singer. It had to be additional to something else that was far more sort of patriotic or masculine. Or how amazing.
It's interesting.
Yeah, for sure. And we, music and portraiture and how that relationship forms. I mean, you and I met when you did there was a project at the Red House that we were involved in, which was a lovely concert. I seem to remember we also provided pastries for it. Pastries and portraits.
The most memorable part.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we do love an alliteration. And you presented some of the portraits in the Royal College of Music collection, and then we heard some of the music by that musician, and then mm-hmm. heard all the great stories behind those portraits. And that was a really sort of insightful and lovely event. And I was just remembering some of the figures that you talked about, and one of them was Coleridge Taylor. Then also Ethel Smythe came up, I believe, in that yes. in that concert as well. And that's something that you're continuing to be interested in is representations of Ethel Smythe.
Yes, so I have been working on that recently. I'm writing a chapter actually on portraits of Ethel Smythe, and she is really interesting to look at in that context because she's someone who was very aware of how she was coming across to the public. She dressed in a very particular way, for example. She often wore green and white and violet, which were the official colours of the suffragettes. Mm-hmm. Obviously, she was a leading suffragette. She wore the March of the Women, which was the suffragette anthem, famously. And some of her contemporaries talk about her running around London in hideous purple dresses and things. So she was very conscious of presenting herself in a particular way. And there's an interesting portrait in the RCM collection of her in her doctoral robe. She was awarded an honorary doctorate in music that she was very, very proud of. And the painting that she commissioned to commemorate this event was by an artist called Neville Lytton, who was himself had some relationships to the suffragettes because his sister was Constance Lytton, leading suffragette.
Of course,
and this portrait yes. that he painted, yeah, and the portrait that he painted of Smythe shows her in her doctoral robes, but it is in the colours green, white and violet. So it's kind of doing two things. On the one hand, it's asserting her status as a musical figure, somebody who is very respected in her field, but also it's got this suffragette's context, a subtext.
Excellent. Yes, I remember I learned for the first time in that talk that green, white and violet, GWV, is deliberate. It's give women the vote or something, or
give women votes.
Give
yes,
women votes. Yeah, no, that yes. blew my mind. I loved that fact.
Yeah.
So from portraits then to death masks, tell us a little about that.
So I mean, I've always had an interest in death masks. I remember seeing one for the first time and at the National Portrait Gallery, and like many people, I was both fascinated and slightly unnerved because they are quite strange objects. But when I joined the RCM, I found that there was a collection of musicians' death masks there, and I started to think about them in a more academic way. So for the last few years, I've been looking at collections and thinking about some of the questions around death masks. You know, why were they made? Who made them? What purpose did they serve? And musicians' death masks are particularly interesting So one of the reasons that people made death masks was because of the pseudosciences of phrenology and physiognomy, which were the beliefs that your features and the arrangement of your features and also the shape and the bumps of your skull corresponded to certain traits in your personality. So these societies were set up, I mean, obviously it's today we would acknowledge it as nonsense, but at the time many people believed in these ideas. And there were societies set up, you know, pseudo-scientific societies, collected death masks and casts of people's skulls to try and point out which features corresponded with which personality traits. So musicians were particularly interesting to them because they could try and identify which sorts of features of a skull might signify genius or talent for music. So you find death masks of people like Chopin and Liszt and Haydn being studied for these sorts of purposes. They became quite fashionable in the late 19th century. For example, the death mask of Beethoven was widely available commercially, and it became a sort of status symbol to have his death mask in your music room or over your piano. It was sort of a sign of a cultured person to have a copy of this on display.
Goodness, so, yeah.
They're strange objects.
They're very strange objects. And it's an interesting sort of byway. It seems to me that you're quite drawn to those sort of interesting taking the lid off history kind of areas. Is that something that you like to explore, a kind of relatively unexplored historical area? And then that must be quite exciting then to just sort of like, oh, okay, I can perhaps
definitely
be involved in explaining
definitely. This. Yeah, I think most of the things that I've worked on have been things where, you know, I've been able to go into archives and look at letters and diaries and all sorts of material about people that have kind of been forgotten by history. A lot of the time that's women, but also I think musicians as well. Some of the opera singers I was working on for my PhD that I was talking about before, they existed before recording technology was around. So some of these singers, you know, have kind of been forgotten. So it was great to be able to go back and find such rich material that hadn't really been studied before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can imagine that.
Definitely.
So we're in Women's History Month, so this is March 2021, and there's a lot of great material coming out, and a lot more, as you say, that often in history the figures that have been less examined have been women because they weren't documented so much, they weren't seen as so important, and their achievements have often been overlooked, and even the extent to which they could participate in a cultural sphere, let's say, was limited by all sorts of things.
Definitely,
just societal things. But you've recently written a really interesting article about Billie Holiday and this kind of cliche of the tragic female performer, the tragic woman. And I was really interested in that. So talk a little bit about that, because interestingly, she's somebody who was incredibly famous and well regarded, yet at the same time has this constant story being told about her. So how did you get into looking at Billie Holiday?
The thing that started me off thinking about, I mean, it's an issue that's always kind of something I've been aware of and frustrated by, how women are talked about, not just musicians, but history in general. But Billie Holiday, the thing that kind of triggered me writing about it was actually a really awful documentary that I saw. I write about in the essay called Queens of Heartache. And this documentary took five random women singers from different genres. I think it was Maria Callas, Billie Holiday, Janis Joplin, and lumped them all together basically on the premise that they were all somehow these tragic figures. And it was just so, it just seemed like such a lazy way to talk about people, focusing on their personal lives and addiction and their relationships particularly. And I just think that really does women a disservice when we focus on those elements of their lives, and it's not something we really see happening with male artists in an equivalent way.
No, I'd be very surprised to see a documentary series called Kings of Heartache
exactly
with the same narrative, even though there are obviously, we'll take Janis Joplin as equivalent, male performers who've died young and in tragic circumstances. That curse of being 27 or whatever it was at some stage, that they, so many of them died at that age.
27 Club.
Yeah, the 27 Club. But you're right. I mean, it made me think of, I watched, there's that biopic of Johnny Cash, Walk the Line.
Yes, yes.
Which tells a very... I mean, I know he comes out the other side of it and doesn't sort of die directly of his addictions, but the narrative is completely different. He obviously has a serious addiction problem and goes right down to rock bottom. But the narrative is sort of redemptive and heroic, really.
Yeah,
and you can quite commonly... I saw a documentary not long ago about him and his performance at the White House under the Nixon administration, and there was no mention of his drug addictions or anything. So he was allowed to narratively have a very different life.
Yeah, definitely.
Whereas it strikes me that Billie Holiday doesn't. Though you were optimistically looking forward in your article to a new documentary, and then there has been a feature film recently as well, hasn't it? Have you seen either of those?
I haven't yet, I haven't. I've been kind of bracing myself.
Yeah.
But no, I think there's been a real resurgence of interest in women. I also mentioned there's been documentaries on Nina Simone, Janis Joplin, which are both critically acclaimed. There were two documentaries on Whitney Houston. So I think there does seem to be, a kind of move towards thinking about women in a more intelligent and nuanced way. Mm-hmm. And particularly the films that are made by women, I think, seem to do that a lot better. But I mean, I think even just the way we talk about female artists reflects this kind of difference in how we talk about men and women. If you think about people, like we call them Billy, Ella, Beyonce, Janice, using their first names. But with men, we talk about Dylan, Hendrix, Sinatra. It kind of, bestows a sort of gravity on and respect on male artists that seems to focus on their kind of cultural significance and achievements. Whereas with women, we're much more interested in their personal lives and who they were married to, or, what they were getting up to off stage in a way that's not equivalent.
Yes, that's really true, isn't it? I'm just remembering a documentary I saw about even someone that perhaps seems unlikely figure to do this to, which would be Doris Day, who was the epitome of the sort of sunshine and wholesome Americanness. But again, a documentary, but underneath there was this dark side, and she had these tragic relationships, that you're thinking, okay, you're sort of bracing yourself for the... the fragility, the vulnerability story. Mm. And it gets very tiresome.
And Maria Callas as well. She's another one. There was a documentary on BBC over Christmas. I don't know if you saw that.
No, I didn't see that, no.
You know that? The same kind of interest in her personal life.
Mm. Yes. Yes, and Marilyn Monroe is perhaps the kind of uber narrative above all that, that attracts so much fascination. It's seemingly because of this mix of, she was a great movie star, but she had this tragic past, but she was actually really smart, yet she was still tragic. And I'm always, there's a lovely story that Bonnie Greer wrote a play about her, didn't she? About the fact that she managed to get Ella Fitzgerald to perform in a bar, in a club in LA that had a colour bar on it. Yes. But Marilyn Monroe said, well, I will come every night, because I want to hear her. And then actually sort of allowed that to be a non-colour bar evening the nights that she was there. So there's those kind of stories. You sort of cling to them a bit because you kind of think, okay, so she wasn't just someone who was at the mercy of all the men she was married to and a tragic victim. She did stuff. She lived a life.
Definitely. I mean, and it still happens, relatively recently with people like Amy Winehouse. When I was growing up, she was always in the newspapers. And I think, she's kind of, I talk a little bit about in my chapter, she's a kind of modern equivalent of Billie Holiday in some ways, in terms of things she's dealing with, crime and addiction and her relationships and the way in which, the press really were vultures with her. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like, she became too successful. When women get to a certain point, people just love to see the downfall.
Yes, and the recent revelations about Britney Spears as well,
definitely.
Similar kind of story. Yeah, goodness me, there's too many of them, aren't there? In terms of your musical background, what are your musical interests? What do you like to listen to?
Well, for me, I mean, people might not be what you expect considering I work at the Royal College of Music, but my real love is rock music. Mm-hmm. So I grew up with my dad's classic rock CD collection, and a lot of my favourite artists are kind of Led Zeppelin, Janis Joplin, people like that, and Billie Holiday I love. So, I mean, I listen to all sorts of music. My partner's a jazz musician, so I go and see a lot of jazz. So I suppose, rock would be my first love.
Oh, I totally understand that. I have a great love of disco that is probably mentioned far too often on this podcast. But
I love disco.
Yeah, who doesn't? I mean, everyone should love disco. Surely everyone does love disco.
Happy music. That's what we need at the moment.
Exactly. Exactly. So, mm-hmm. And so speaking of which, I threw this at you just before we started recording, which was that we have a podcast playlist. Mm-hmm. We like to contribute a couple of tracks to it from each guest, and then I throw in a couple of my own. So I wondered if you had a couple of things that caught your ear lately that you'd like to contribute, or anything, or just tracks that you think the world should know.
Well, we've been talking about Ethel Smythe, and she has been in the news this week because I don't know if you saw, but she won a Grammy Award. That weekend, a recording of one of her operas won a Grammy Award. So I think Ethel Smythe needs to go on there. So maybe March of the Women, her suffragette anthem. Then I suppose Billie Holiday, we've been talking about her, she has to go on there too. Lady in Satin is my favourite album, okay. Billie Holiday, so mm-hmm. maybe something from there.
Absolutely so. Lady in Satin, okay, great. And Ethel Smythe. Well, I'll contribute a Billie Holiday track too, because reading your article got me listening to her again, and I loved her version of Speak Low, the Kurt Weill song. It's absolutely mm-hmm. lovely. It's quite a light song, and I just love the sort of slightly sly way she sings it. It's mm-hmm. absolutely brilliant. Mm-hmm. And other than that, I did a project on Twitter recently, which was kind of a year in music. And so we'd look at a year and what was just all being written that year, including one Britain piece and then some other whatever else was being composed. So you build up a kind of picture of a year. I came across all kinds of strange things I'd never heard before. And it was a harp concertino by a composer called Ferenc Farkas, who I had never heard of before. Yeah. And from an album of harp concertos. So I think I will add that just for the joy of spreading the word about Ferenc Farkas. But feel free to add a rock music track if you feel compelled to, because I would be...
Oh yeah, maybe you can put some Janis Joplin on there.
Certainly. So what's next for you, Anna? What are you working on at the moment?
So I am working on several articles about death masks at the moment. I'm waiting for restrictions to lift because I've got some funding to go and work with some collections in Austria. I should mention as well, I'm working in collaboration on all of the death mask things with one of my very good friends, Dr. Verity Burke. So we've been travelling around together, working as international death mask detectives.
Okay, there's a series about that, surely.
If Netflix are interested, they know where to find me. But no, I'm looking forward to getting back into some archives and collections when things lift and everything goes back to normal.
Yes. So, well, I mean, I suppose we're closer than we were. But I've been doing this podcast series. I did two not in my kitchen, and the rest have been pretty much from home over the last year. So
it's a great idea.
Well, thank you very much for coming on today, and yes, talking us through your remarkably wide range of historical interests. It's been great talking to you.
Thank you very much for having me.